What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the Dual Screens Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Stephen Fontana, and with me, as always, he's Andy Asimakis. How you doing, buddy?
Steve, can you remind me always and forever to scroll down to the system requirements on any Steam page I encounter? Because I scroll down to our guest Steam page right now to prepare for this interview, and there are some nuggets of joy. There's some really good shit.
Oh, yes, there is.
There's good shit.
Oh, I'm reading. Okay. Okay. Well, we'll get into that after we do our introduction.
Yeah, we should get into this. But
indeed,
for the listeners out there, do that too. Why not?
We're going to go on the journey together.
Yeah.
Don't worry. We'll go on the journey together. Joining us this week is Spencer Yan, creator of My Work Is Not Yet Done, a narrative-driven investigative horror game. Ooh, spoopy. Yeah, these games, we were saying right before we hit the record button, there's something so unsettling about this whole aesthetic that makes me immediately uncomfortable. Spencer, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Spencer.
Hello, everybody. I am Spencer, as introduced.
What's going on, man? How are you?
I'm doing okay. I'm hanging in all right.
It's nice to meet a person, the person that puts this into the world. And that you're not, at least you don't appear to be, a complete sociopath. So that's good.
I can guarantee you I am not.
Excellent. Oh no, that's good. That's a good
sentimental individual.
excellent. Because I will give you a little what. One of the two of us is a sociopath.
Complete and utter psychotic.
So you will figure that out by the end of the show. It's a little game we play. Which one of us is the psycho? Okay. You'll figure it out.
That should be a question. Who has been institutionalized between Steven and Andy?
Yes. Which one of us?
The answer may surprise you.
Click this link. Welcome to the Dual Screens Podcast, the internet's number one indie developer interview podcast hosted by people you've never heard of. Probably. The show posts each and every week for your listening pleasure on your podcast service of choice, including our home, Podbean. And of course, if you want to support us, you could do so by following or subscribing to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/DualScreensTV. You can also support us on Patreon, patreon.com/DualScreens, just like our Patreon producer Colton the Apprentice Nestler, who has been supporting us for most of our, as of recording this episode, 6-year journey.
Holy hell.
Here at Dual Screens, we are celebrating 6 years today on May 15th 2023. Congratulations, Andy. Congratulations, Spencer, for being one of the two guests that we've interviewed on our anniversary.
Congratulations to you guys for 6 years.
You did it, buddy.
That's really something to be proud of.
Can you believe it, Spencer? Based on the intro of this, which is 3 minutes and 3 seconds ago, can you believe we have done this for 6 years?
Oh, look, 6 years ago, I wasn't in high school. Never mind. I was going to say I was in high school. So it was, so that's a very long time.
It's a long time.
I think Spencer caught wind of our podcast 6 years ago. He's like, I'm going to make a game to one day get on the show 6 years from now.
Yes. Lofty goals from Spencer. Lofty goals. Well, just like your work is not done, our work is not done yet either, because we have indie games that we want to highlight till the end of time. And this episode is going to be all about My Work Is Not Yet Done. Spencer, before we dive into the meat and potatoes, why don't you tell everybody what is My Work Is Not Yet Done?
Sure. So My Work Is Not Yet Done is, like you said earlier, it's an investigative horror game that, on one hand, it's kind of about, you know, at a very general surface level, it's about this scientist that's sent into this research area, and the game sort of covers the last couple of days of her life as she sort of seeks out this strange radio signal of sorts. But on a sort of more abstract level, I think it's a game that's very much about the failure of the scientific process, and sort of like, you know, when people think about how the process of science works, you know, typically when movies or books or whatever show that kind of thing, it's a very sort of like, you know, you're kind of just sitting there, and then one day it comes to you and there's this great discovery, and then the answer is solved and everything's resolved. But I wanted to portray it a little bit more realistically. So, you know, it's focused more on the process of kind of like frustration and disappointment. And it's a very slow and kind of tedious process. And by the end, you don't really know anything much more than you did at the start anyways. So,
well, that's not a very enticing reason to play a game.
I mean, that's, you know, yeah, that's. I try to be as honest as possible about my work. You know, I think that I would find that premise interesting. I can accept that a lot of people don't. My publisher takes a lot of, they're a bit iffy about me talking about it this way, because of course they want to sell the game to as many people as possible. But I also think that, you know, the work is fundamentally challenging in a way that I think it's better to just be honest with people instead of trying to convince them it's something that it's not.
Well, I mean, some of the best works of film and even television, like there are certain TV shows that are still spoken about to this day based on the conclusion, and like people have theories of what it meant and all that stuff. So there, you're not alone in that theory of it's not necessarily the destination, but the journey is what's really important here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Andreas, do you have a ceremonial first question outside of now that we know what my work is not done, not yet done is?
Well, I know the answer to this question, but I want to get Spencer's.
You want to hear it from the horse's mouth.
I kind of want to get Spencer's take, because I think it's hard. It's difficult for a horror fan to ask this question, because I know I kind of get what the answer would be, but I want to get Spencer's take. How could a game that looks like this possibly be scary?
This is a difficult question that I've actually had to wrestle with a lot myself. I think, okay, don't get me wrong, I think the game has some truly horrific image. There are certain things in it that I think are just very troubling just to look at. You know, I look at them in my sprite editor and they make me uncomfortable just looking at them. But I think beyond that, the goal isn't really... I think the horror is sort of more... I wouldn't even say subdued, but just kind of drawn out over a longer period of time. And so when you look, like, the graphics themselves are intentionally designed in such a way that it's like, I don't really want the player to really understand what they're looking at. There are certain moments where there will be things that the player will look at and they won't, hopefully they won't immediately comprehend what they're looking at. But, you know, it sort of tricks the player into, or not tricks, but it creates this kind of ambiguity, I think, that that invites a certain level of speculation. I would say that that's how a lot of the visual horror, or how the horror in the game works visually. I think there's also stuff thematically too that obviously extends beyond the visuals, but
it's a very Lovecraftian answer. I love that. I love how that's like one of my favorite forms of horror, when you're looking at something or it's being described to you, you can't quite get grips on what it is you're looking at, and that into itself adds another layer of horror.
Yeah, that's actually a big component of it. One of the sort of things that I'm kind of interested in exploring with it is, like I was talking about earlier about the process of science. Science itself, the scientific process relies so much on kind of like collecting data about things, but you collect data through instruments. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, something that scares me a lot is like when things like TVs or like, you know, my phone or shit like that starts just wigging out all of a sudden, like they made this movie about like a Zoom call actually, like being haunted.
Oh, Unfriended! It's like
there was Unfriended.
Oh, there was another one that came. Was it the pandemic one that came out? Yeah, like
it's British. Host, I think it's called.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I watched that.
That's a good one.
Yeah, those movies scare they scare me so much, because it's like I always assume that like the stuff that I'm looking at, that I interact with daily, is like it's gonna work, you know, because it's just, I don't know, I'm just familiar with it. And when tech gets haunted and stuff, you know, typically in horror, it's usually like very kind of old. It's like older tech, like, you know, VHS tapes or like cassette tapes. Or
yeah.
But sorry, to go back to the original question, I think that one of the points of horror for me is like when interfaces fail or when instruments fail. So throughout the game, you'll be interacting with a lot of different kinds of interfaces, you know, like satellite imagery, like microphones, like audio tapes and stuff like that, or like radio recordings, radio signals. But, you know, they'll be transmitting to you like a lot of data or a lot of like stuff, basically. And the player sometimes will understand what it is, sometimes they won't. And there's also this kind of disconnect between the character the player is playing as and the player themselves, like, because she knows more than the player does, obviously. And so there's this constant level of kind of discomfort about, like, you never really trust what it is you're looking at. And when things go wrong, you don't exactly know if they're going wrong the right way, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that that's like a very unnerving feeling, you know.
There's a little, so when I was a kid and Scream had just come out, right? Like that was like a big thing for a lot of kids my age. I think I was like 13, maybe, I don't know, something around there. And there's two things that happen in those scenarios. It's like you are so heightened to the fact that you're preparing yourself to be scared, right?
Yeah.
And I remember as a kid when we rented the movie after it had been out, and we're watching it, and you're focused on it because you're so heightened and you don't want to be scared, and you know when something scary is going to happen. There was this part where we all paused it and we were like, dude, the killer's in here in the very beginning. And you're like, what are you talking about? And I remember us rewinding this VHS tape one frame at a time, and you could see the outline of the ghost face mask, but it's done with the lighting and the way the leaves are hitting the tree in the chick's backyard. It is not intentional, I don't think. But our brains as kids that are terrified turned this leaf like shadow into the ghost face mask.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what your art direction kind of reminds me of, is like, I'm looking for something creepy in every frame where it's just unsettling having that mindset where you may not actually be showing me something that is supposed to frighten me, but because my brain is already trained to be unsettled, that it's already scaring me.
Yeah, I think that's actually a really interesting way of putting it. For me, like visually speaking, I actually don't approach that as explicit. I never really thought about it that way actually, but that's very strongly that's very much kind of how I approach the audio design. So I'm an audio designer outside of like making games, but you know, a lot of the stuff is like what is the difference between a natural sound and a sound that you hear? So like, for example, like sometimes I'll just be sitting in my room, and then like obviously after I finish watching a horror film, every little creak or every little like noise that my house makes sounds like something, like it's like, oh, that's like potentially a danger, or like but like that's kind of in a very similar capacity to how you, when you were a child, imagined that like there was this face there that was maybe wasn't there, maybe it was there, maybe it wasn't, maybe probably wasn't intended to be. But the way that the sort of game's audio is meant to be built is kind of like you never really understand what it is. You think that you know what it is you're hearing, but you know, just the sound of the, like the wind moving through the trees, for example, you could hear things in that. Like, I sit right next to a forest every night and I listen to it, I think, which is a big part of the inspiration for that. But, you know,
now, like, when you're designing it, are you putting actual sounds in there that are there, or are you literally just putting like stuff that you're hoping people get a little creeped out by?
Sometimes there's in the most broadest sense, sometimes there are things there that are meant to just be false, kind of false flags. Sometimes there are things there that are meant to genuinely be things. I'll put it that way.
Andy, do you remember, and I'm sure you did this because you're just one of the strangest people I've ever met as far as horror goes. Did you do the whole Beatles album playing it backwards record?
Oh yeah.
So
that was a thing.
That is another thing that I look at with sound, because when you, again, you're training your brain to be on high alert. So if you do that, play any record backwards, you hear Satan. Like it's just what you just hear the ghosts and Satan. Yeah. And so like, just talking about this right now, I can see behind me, and I swear to God, there's like something in my light right now. And I don't want to turn around. It's creeping me out. The hairs on the back of my neck are standing up.
While you were saying that, in my peripheral vision, there's something like twitching on the ground next to me.
Uh-huh.
It's the fucking dog on his back with his belly up.
Yeah. The cutest thing possible infiltrating your cerebellum.
I'm not used to seeing that there.
Yeah.
Ever.
Yeah.
From this position.
The hair on the back of my neck is literally standing up. This is it creeps me out just to be in this mindset.
So Spencer, how did you arrive at this particular like art style? Was it just, this is what you've always done? Like, are you a pixel art guy, or just this was the best medium to deliver this particular story?
So it was a confluence of a bunch of stuff. When I was, I'm not going to say I was like trained, but I used to be a landscape painter, or I wanted to be a landscape
painter. Holy shit.
Younger. Yeah. Yeah. I did watercolor paintings.
Oh, wow.
I did a lot of sort of I mean, where I'm from in New Jersey, it's just like, oh, there's just a lot of greenery. It's a lot of forests. We live right next to the border of New York. So, you know, I spent a lot of time drawing leaves and like getting the ability to sort of like, you know, people see like a massive like green or whatever. And so it was like part of my interest when I was younger was being able to like take this very sort of, you know, something that looks like a mass and like turn it into like something that's like somewhat comprehensible. Like when you look at a painting, sometimes if you zoom in close enough, it's just a bunch of little strokes or like a bunch of little, right. like, you know, lines. You know, same way that when you take a look at like any kind of picture or digital picture, you zoom in far enough, it's just a bunch of pixels. I'd say that like my, that kind of informed my ability to think about or to look at some or to think about things in black and white, which is to say that like I think when a lot of people approach sort of like, oh, how is my work going to look, or how is the thing I'm working on going to look, black and white is sort of, it's a bit taboo, or people like, I think they feel a bit more uncomfortable using it because they feel like they can't get as expressive with it as possible. But for me, I didn't have that initial barrier, I think, because of my background there. As for why I've chosen it for this particular project, and to be completely honest, probably my future projects, it was a combination of, I mean, the first is that it's very easy to generate these images. So I paint basically over a lot of photographs. I have a drone, actually. So a lot of like the forest ground and stuff is a photogrammed sort of like compositions, or the like they're 3D compositions that I then.
That's really kind of, interesting.
Yeah.
Do you like break it down into layers? Like, are you able to like import into your program like the foreground, paint that first, and then layer it on something else, and like kind of to give it that animated depth?
That's exactly how it works. So
that's awesome.
Like, I don't want to get too technical about this.
No, please do. I mean, we're an indie game. We're about making games and the people who make them. So you want to nerd out about this shit? That's what we're here for, man.
Yeah, sure. So basically what happens is it does the drone, basically, I send it up. It flies around. It gets a perfect top-down shot, which then forms a ground layer. Then it flies towards like a kind of, like that kind of three quarters angle that the game takes place at. Sometimes I take just regular pictures of things from a three quarters angle, like a stone or something. Mm-hmm. And those all get basically scanned into a program where then I shrink the picture down real small, mm-hmm. and I paint over basically. Of course, this is just the environment. For stuff like animations and stuff, I hand draw those because it's difficult to rotoscope when you're working with like 6 pixels, but
you don't say.
But
and yet there's still so much detail though, which is
that's
amazing.
What you get from the photo. Yeah. People have always been kind of struck by the kind, I'm not gonna call the game photorealistic, but there's a kind of aspiration towards a sort of like a visual, like
it's like demastered.
It's lo-fi. I wouldn't even say it's lo-fi. I explicitly try to move away from lo-fi because lo-fi like crunches everything down to like, you know, elementary colors. Like I think it's very difficult to have like a true sort of, you know, hard black white game, or like hard 1-bit game, I guess, in lo-fi, because then you basically are just relying on outlines, so you have very little clarity. But for mine, I think the, you know, I see it in a more kind of, I don't know, painterly sounds a bit pretentious, but like I think I regard each of the scenes as sort of like a composition in its own right. So it's like, you know, there are places where the player is intentionally going to be obscured. For example, like how I communicate sort of this feeling of getting lost in a forest is I basically allow trees to paint over the player. But then when the player goes into the quote unquote pause menu, or the interface at which they access like the pause functions in a traditional game, it turns into a satellite view, which you could see, you know, the character projected through this thermal imaging device. So if the player wants to locate the character in a scene where the character feels inherently lost, they have to rely on this external technology, this external interface, which again goes back to my original point about distrusting interfaces, because eventually that satellite view becomes compromised in ways that I'm not going to talk about like right now. But
see who's watching them, that satellite.
And also what they see, what the player sees, because it detects heat signatures. Always I'm trying to get to go back to the original point before I was talking about the satellite. When the player gets, like, people have complained about the fact that like the player sometimes gets like lost in like all the visual noise, which I think it's a very valid kind of complaint. Like, but I would also argue that that's a bit intentional, because, you know, the game is very much about like sort of the disappearance of people into environments, or the sort of like the ways in which kind of people become lost, like both in like a you know, in a literal sense, and also sort of like in a more, I don't know, like not metaphorical.
It's,
maybe
it's also immersive. It's an immersive experience. Like if I were you, I would just tell them, yeah, don't worry, you'll find her again. Like, don't worry. She'll,
and that's part of the horror.
Yeah. Like she's going to show up again. Like it's, you'll be okay. Like, you know, it's okay.
Look, I'm not making a shooter. Like, the player doesn't need to always be looking directly at the character. That's kind of how I
like. Look at the world. Look at the overall picture. It there's something about it. It reminds me a lot of the Game Boy camera, where you take a picture of a beautiful tree.
Spot on description.
You take a picture of a beautiful like forest through a Game Boy camera, and you're gonna be like, I know this is a forest, but like not even the picture, like watching the video through the Game Boy. Like that's what it reminds me of. Like, cause when you take a picture, it just kind of breaks it down to like just a bunch of lines. But if you're looking at the image and you're moving the camera and the Game Boy camera, like you get this like surreal, almost like, again, it's like a photorealism, but it's not, it's like through this weird lens and lack of fidelity that kind of gives it this what's the word I'm looking for, this novelty almost. It's like a you know, that's, it's like a big thing. Like the Game Boy camera right now is going for like $200-$300 because like really? people are like trying to use this and make art out of it, like in today's life. There's filters for it on cameras, like, or on phones, like you could do that old school stuff. So you could actually make a film out of this if you'd like. You know what? Andy and I, we live in New York. You're in Jersey. You're probably right over there, right across from Rockland County, I imagine. Orange County, maybe.
Yeah.
You're right over there. You're just an hour and so, or hour or so away from us. We'll make a,
yeah, man. We'll make that a drone for B-roll. It'll be great.
Yeah. My work is not yet done. The movie. Except, we could find the lead for this. We could do it.
I mean, it's a one character game. Like,
yeah. Well,
effectively a one character game. So
Andy will be the guy that's watching her from the stars, the creep
role I was born to play. the guy looking through the trees.
I could be the crazy guy that's trying to sell her like buttons. Like buttons. I just found these buttons. Like, hey, what are you doing in these woods? And I have a button if you're interested. So my colon.
what is the sort of core gameplay loop in this game? You mentioned folks getting lost, so
investigating.
What is the actual gameplay component?
Gathering clues.
I understand that, but what is us through?
It's almost as if Andy's never played a game before. We're just kidding. I'm just teasing him.
Yeah, no, I think it's a very important question. I mean, it's one that for a long time I kind of like had difficulty answering for myself, because I think when I originally sort of pitched the game on the Kickstarter, it was intended to be a much smaller project, and it was also intended to be much more sort of survival based. So the character was supposed to just survive, like, and there was a semblance of a story, but not so much. But I think as I've sort of, I don't know, I've been working on this thing for like 5 years now, which is like 4.5 years, which is honestly 3.5 years too long. But
interesting.
That beside the point, I think that I've changed it, or my vision of what the game is has changed a lot more. Once again, to what I was thinking about, or what I was talking about earlier, when it comes to sort of like the pursuit of the scientific process, or sort of like the actual practice of the scientific process, which in its sort of like the nitty gritty sort of like moment to moment gameplay, which is like how I think about it myself, or how I force myself to think about it. Basically, it involves, it kind of just involves sitting at a desk and looking at a monitor of things and basically monitoring a bunch of stuff, reading through a bunch of data. And then, you know, you observe instruments, you watch instruments, and when instruments happen, like break down or like you get anomalous data, you go out and you check to see what it is. Mm. And if it's nothing, you come back, which granted, extremely boring, extremely boring description. But I think that describing it, I'd rather under describe it than
describe it.
Well, listen, not boring enough, because you got a publisher on this recently too. So you're doing something right. So don't be like, it's not the most exciting game in the world. They don't all got to be these AAA gangbusters. The minimalist approach works very well.
You don't
have
to level up in every video game. Right. You know what I mean? Like there doesn't need to be power-ups and everything. Like sometimes you just need to, sometimes we need a good story to string us along and keep us moving left to right, up and down, and interacting with the world.
I'd say the game, I don't know, this isn't really part of the gameplay loop, specifically from a mechanical level, but I think that one of the important things that I've repeatedly highlighted, both to players and to the publisher and to myself as well, is that the game is actually very reactive behind the scenes. Like, I don't know, this is kind of like a sort of joke thing at this point, but at one point I had like this whole sort of very detailed, planned out like digestive system where, you know, it wasn't just a hunger bar. It was tracking sort of like the individual flow of like, you know, liquids and solids through our digestive system, which it's in the game still. Technically, it's excessive by like every measure. But I think that's kind of how I approach everything. I see everything as like an interaction of systems. So, you know, there's no health bar in this game, for example. Like the ultimate barometer or like the equivalent of the health bar in this game is sort of her willpower, her ability to sort of adhere to her missions like requirements. And every little thing feeds into that, and everything in the world also, or not everything in the world, but all the major sort of things in the world, the story itself, or the way that the story progresses responds to how the player interacts with things. And so everything is kind of very freeform. The story is very freeform. And there are multiple kind of, I don't want to call them like quests, but they're like, they're different points of curiosity that the player can...
Different threads you can kind of pull on a
exactly
little bit.
And, yeah. the game will kind of react to those, and sort of things will change within how the player understands them based on what the player themselves is naturally curious about. For example, some players might be very invested in sort of like the technological approach where you're just sitting there and you're looking at sensors and you're monitoring sensors and you're trying to just get all the data right. Other players may like not want to sit in front of a screen all the entire time, and they go out and try to look for things in their own. Other players may just want us, I don't know, sit there and like harvest worms or something. You could harvest worms in the game to eat as food. I'm trying to anticipate and also simultaneously limit the amount of player interaction so that every single thing, that every possible way that the player chooses to play the game is considered both like mechanically and narratively and thematically like not relevant, but viable is the word.
Why am I eating worms again?
Sustenance.
They exist. I mean, worms.
Is it like tethered to the overarching plot in a sense, or
it's tethered? It's tethered to the greater lore of the world. It's tethered to the greater lore of the worlds. This game exists as kind of like the prologue to like a much longer body of works that I want to sort of explore in later games. But like this one is sort of more light on the society that she comes from, and sort of like, you know, but effectively you can go into this underground area in the bunker where they grow like these special kinds of worms for protein. And they basically, you take the worms and you like, you cook them, you fry them, and then you grind them up into a powder, and that's protein powder. It's a real thing.
I've seen cricket powder. Yeah. I've seen all that stuff.
People do it with crickets. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So, you know, it's a good source of protein.
I'm thoroughly intrigued by this. And this isn't a genre I normally like.
See, this is what I love it when there's like stuff in the background. Like it's an established world of things that there's already rules happening already before this game takes place. And that's like all just kind of background noise to what the bigger mystery is revolving around, like this person's work and their entries and all of that.
You know, I see, you know, in a kind of way, I've always, like, the sort of jokey but also somewhat serious way that I've described this game is it's effectively a wiki that you walk through, like, that you literally walk through.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, the narrative of the game is layered in such a way that, you know, it's obviously you have, like, the central mystery, which is the one that's ongoing. But then you have the kind of mystery of trying to figure out, like, this woman is, like, some 100 days into this mission. Like, what happened to the other 100 days? You know, what happened to the other characters that are shown in the cover? And then there are other sort of, like, you know, you can discover more about the actual, like, society that she comes from by reading, like, you know, I've done a lot of work into creating, like, sort of very kind of realistic feeling, like, recreations of, like, certain technological interfaces and, like, documentation stuff. So it's like you can read about like the kind of society that they come from and like, you know, what they could potentially value, what kinds of people they are, what systems of belief they have. And then there's other things that like tie to like, you know, the region itself or like the other characters. So it's all like, you know, like I said, a wiki that you can guide a character through instead of like just clicking on links.
I got to ask you, what are some of your main inspirations and influences in horror?
In horror?
Mm-hmm. I see what informs your game development process.
You know, I actually don't play that many. Well, I play a lot of horror games, but like I don't really
read, watch, play, whatever you consume. Yeah,
I think that, so I would say that my biggest influences are kind of just for this particular game are the fact I used to spend a lot of time out in the woods. I was or like just sort of like on these very long walks, basically. I've done part of some of the AT trail. I've done a very short segment of the PCT, but like I have a lot of experience kind of just walking for very long periods of time through environments where there just aren't that many people. So that was one part of it, and that kind of pushed up against my horror of just kind of like the ambient sort of technological environment, if that makes sense. Like kind of you know, like I was describing before, this like fear of screens. And in that sense, I'd say there's probably like two films that really inform that, which are The Grudge and this film called it's called Pulse. Yeah, Kiyoshi Kurosawa's Pulse.
Good stuff, man.
Yeah, Cure also informs another backstory in this game to an extent. His Kiyoshi Kurosawa's other film, Cure. That's not Pulse. I draw a lot of horror from. I'm training to be a priest. So like I draw a lot of horror.
What?
From
sort
of, yeah.
Can we?
And another layer of the onion has been peeled.
That is a wow. Of all the answers, of all the things you could have went into.
But there's fascinating. There's a long kind of tradition of sort of. I don't want to say Christian horror, because Christian horror is now just like basically I don't know, like
the devil did it.
The Conjuring. It's like the Conjuring films. You basically have like this priest superhero and his wife, who's like his like seance wife, or not seance, his clairvoyant wife, and they just this superhero team, and they cast out demons. Like,
oh yeah, she's like, you know, the spiritual one. He's like the grounded science one, kind of a thing. They're like an oddball pair.
Yeah, but then like they just go and like perform exorcisms. Like they're like, I don't know. Like I would say, like I think Christian horror gets mixed up too much of that. Like, you know, like the idea of the devil as this thing that exists. But I think that I'm more broadly interested in sort of like, I guess a more ancient approach where it's less sort of tied specifically to like doctrines of horror or horror of doctrines that have emerged kind of like in the past two centuries, and towards sort of like how more ancient cultures, I guess, thought about their relationship with like the world. You know, there used to be a time when people believed that like we just lived in a world where there were just spirits, like spirits roam the earth like animals did, you know, and you wouldn't go past the edge of your village, or like, you know, you would believe in sort of like gods and you would pray to gods or saints as a mode of kind of, you know, literally just like being able to exist in a world where you're just surrounded by like a very real and like physical sense of evil. And while I don't know, I don't want to sort of really inject my own kind of, you know, I don't want people to come away from this and be like, oh, this game is like a Christian game or whatever. That, like, I feel like that would be a failure on my end. But I do think that there's a lot of, I'm focused more on sort of the anxieties of, I think, a broader kind of religious experience than I am specifically on like, you know, like fighting the devil or something like that, or the dark night of the soul, things like that, you know, or cliches like that. So that's another sort of avenue, which I think is, I don't know, it's a bit more unusual, I guess, as far as these things go.
Got it. So you're making the Bible Avengers of horror games.
Yeah, there you go. So this is the 40 nights in the desert kind of thing? Is that what we're doing here? I get it. All right.
No, not really, actually. I'm just...
I know,
but that's interesting, because that's something that people were worried about, because I remember doing an interview a couple of years ago with, I think it was Eurogamer, and there a lot bunch of the comments were concerned that like I was going to take this as be like, oh, at the end, the character just finds God. I mean, I can't say the character doesn't find God, but I think the answer that they find is, or the sort of like the imminent that they find is, it's a much different one. Something that I'm really interested in, for example, that probably would interest Andy is... kind of the resurgence, I guess, or maybe sort of the surge in popularity in Lovecraftian horror, specifically, or probably like cosmic horror. Right. I'm very interested in the ways that sort of like that kind of interacts with like the notion of atheology, and like you know, when we talk about sort of like all these grounded, like, or when we talk about all these abstract things, how we sort of reflect that into our lived experiences. I would say that, you know, my, like, the theological horror in my games is much more and closer to kind of like the Lovecraftian anxiety of like, of finding yourself suddenly alone or suddenly like in the presence of something that you just do not understand. And you know, the only thing you know about it is that you know you cannot understand it. That's kind of like the greater sort of anxiety that I'm interested in exploring.
Yeah. Yeah. And we've all kind of, I think we've all been there in a point in our lives where we feel like, again, we're stuck in this place of darkness or anxiety. We can't quite pinpoint the source of it, the cause of it. I think I like your approach. There's like clearly a science element to it, but then there's this theological sort of thing also that's in the back of your mind, but not entirely guiding the story or the vision.
Yeah.
There's a lot of like, there's a lot of information out there or studies or paths that entertainers take about the psychology of religion, but there's not a lot of the religion of psychology where it's like, you know, there's a reason why your brain goes to certain things in time of desperation, in time of need or of fright. There's a reason why that happens, but what is that reason? We don't really know or nor understand, and honestly probably can't understand. But every society in every corner of the world throughout all of time has come up with a form of that reasoning, and we can't really explain why. And that lends itself to, like you were saying, the cosmic unknown, the uncomfortability and the fear and the horror of it all.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's something that I kind of, you know, not necessarily tangential to this, actually pretty related to this, but something that I've kind of been interested in, sort of like, you know, why now? Why now has Lovecraft suddenly, like, you know, seen such a surge in interest? Why have people spent so much time going through the works of, like, I don't know, like Ramsey Campbell or Thomas Ligotti, for example, or what's his name? China Melville, I think. But like these authors that are
dropping all the names right now you can think of.
or like, I don't know. Let's put another one. People often compare my game to Annihilation or Jeff Vandermeer's.
Annihilation is one of my favorites.
That trilogy. All time.
Holy and it's shit. Like,
why now has this suddenly seen such a resurgence when, you know, and sometimes people offer the answer is like anxiety. But like, we lived through the 20th century, man. I mean, like, there was like two like world wars, basically, like, you know, in the span of 30 years, dudes went from riding horses to like, you know, nuclear bombs being dropped from like hyperpowered jets. Like, it's, you know, and then we went to the Cold War. So it's like, it's not anxiety that necessarily creates it, but it's a very specific kind, I think, of like fear that emerges in sort of like the collapse of. Because for Lovecraft, like, to return back to not the origin, but the origin at least of the, like, the contemporary sort of, you know, sentiment. Lovecraft is like, we now have to reckon with the fact that Lovecraft was in many ways a deeply problematic figure. Mm-hmm. You know, he was plagued by all these kinds of like racial and sort of like, you know, separatist anxieties. He was deeply elitist. He was deeply classist. But in a lot of ways, those things also directly informed his capacity to like grasp and come into continuous contact with a certain kind of like, you know, profound, just like not just fear, but like an act of terror of like basically the outside world, you know, the world at large.
Right.
And I don't know. I think that we're kind of entering into a similar sort of phase. You know, obviously we don't like, not everybody shares, you know, for the better, not everybody shares like Lovecraft's like intense sort of like, you know, sociopolitical like perspectives. But I think there is a similar kind of like, you know, just distrust of, you know, one's fellow human beings that I think, you know, it very much illuminates and sort of gives rise or gives sort of nascence to a, like we're now able to understand in a much more visceral way, I think, because we exist in a time where there's this kind of this, I'm not going to say unprecedented, but at least like, you know, very sort of like a new or novel feeling, like a, you know, just distrust of people, like,
well, I mean, listen, over the course of the lockdowns and the pandemic, I feel a lot of us, like, we somehow learned not to trust even our neighbors anymore.
Yeah.
Out of fear of them getting us sick or the ones we love sick. So I get it. Like, it's a thriving mentality, you know?
I think also it has a lot to do with how connected we all are at 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, where, and, you know, to take the anxiety out of the equation, I know it's hard to do, but like, if you just take that, if you pretend that doesn't exist, there's still human curiosity and tribalism. And once the next cool thing happens, it spreads like wildfire. Mm-hmm. So not everybody that consumes that media might be consumed with the anxiety that follows that, you know, philosophy, but it could just be like, this is the cool new thing everybody is talking about. Let me get in there. And then boom. Oh yeah, this is dope. And then they kind of fall down that rabbit hole of like, why is this dope to me? Like, what? But that first hook is, I feel like, because we're so connected and we could have literally a million people today tell us how dope it is without us even experiencing it, and already have FOMO of it and want to be in it and want to experience it for completely different reasons than people of Lovecraftian time that might have been, you know, looking for that experience or, you know, not necessarily be looking for that experience, but getting it anyway. I just think it's a whole new world. Like, when I talk to my parents about the things that used to scare them as kids, like, my mom was terrified of Jaws, and like, that like made a lot of people afraid of sharks, but that wasn't the first time anybody spoke about a shark attack. Mm-hmm. It's just that it was worldwide. It reached a lot of people very quickly. Now imagine that for literally anything at any given moment to billions of people. Like, it's just so fast. And, you know, keeping up with it as a society is becoming harder and harder, and attention spans are getting shorter and shorter. And yeah, I think that has a lot to do with why that sort of thing is exploding as quickly as it is, on top of the, what you said, Andy, about just, you know, looking for a reason to just distrust somebody or be angry at something.
It's a coping mechanism too, because it's a lot of us, when we have that deep level of fear, we don't want to admit it either. And to externalize that in a different way, the different emotion, highly effective and super easy.
Everybody needs therapy. Speaking of therapy, ladies and gentlemen, it's now time to get into our rapid fire section of the show, which is where we get to know you, Spencer.
Great. Okay.
We're going to get to know you.
I feel like I want to drink with Spencer and just wax about horror.
Oh yeah. We're going to Jersey.
To like, talk about it.
Until we close out the bar, basically. And that's where I'm getting at.
Our bars are open later than yours. So maybe make a trip to the city.
I used to actually live in the city. So, you know,
Man. We'll meet up with you. Okay. All right. I'm going to start you off with an easy one. Would you rather have the power of flight or invisibility?
Christ. Okay.
Said the priest.
Says the priest.
He's the pit.
I'm gonna say flight.
Flight, yeah. Because you don't want to get trouble with Jeebus going invisible, taking things.
No, I mean, it's like, why would I want to be invisible? You know, it's like,
I can give you a whole host of reasons.
You know why, Spencer.
Yeah, that's like, invisibility is for voyeurs and thieves, man. And like, the only problem with flight is if, like,
Let's talk about Hitchcock, Spencer. Let's do it.
Okay. Next question. I'm not gonna expand about this.
What scares you?
Everything. So many things. You know, like, one of the worst things in movies is when they do that shit where they like, they show a person just standing in a room, but there's like a dark corner, and it's like, for some reason they always zoom into the corner until it like becomes this weird blurry pixely mess. But then you see like something that looks kind of like a face. Like, Japanese horror movies do this like especially well. Ghost footage always scares me. Like, I don't know, weird faces scares me. Like, the other day I had this thought where like I was walking home at like 10 o'clock at night, and I saw this woman just standing like still in the window, like looking down, but she was like silhouetted because the light was to her back, and I was so scared. But I was, then I thought about it and I was like, wait, is it actually scarier to be in my position where I see her looking at me? Or is it scarier to be in her position where she's standing there and in the middle of the night, some dude just like lurks out of the shadows and just like, and I got scarred by thinking about that. So it's like every little thing, I'm actually very scared. Like I'm a very easily scarable person.
Steve, if you can in post, I love how he said this while there's a nice blank, dark void behind him.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's always the horror game people that have a fucking door behind them that we're just waiting to open up and then get murdered on.
Like, I just imagine fingers just do one of those, like,
yeah, just want to, wrapping like, around. Just something caress your hair, and you're just like, little gray fingers, just like.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, I'm not scared. You know, I will say something though. I'm not scared if I can see it. I'm not scared of it. Like there's some things like are truly just horrifying to look at. But it's like if I can see it, if I can touch it, then it's like okay. What is it gonna do? Just kill me, torture me, like whatever. That's just physical pain.
At least you can fight. You know.
I don't even care about fighting. Like if it just wants to kill me, like whatever. Like you know, like if you're like or it's like if you're a ghost and like you know you just see some dude like you see some dude and you try to scare some dude. He just takes his clothes off. Like what are you gonna do? Like. You know, it's there's a lot of things you can do to shock a ghost because it's like when they're in the physical realm, it's like you can negotiate with them on a physical level the same way you can negotiate with like other things. I don't care about that stuff that I cannot see or stuff that like exists outside of my immediate perception. That really bothers me.
Man, you are quite the onion.
think about it this way: if you were like you know all those horror films about like ghosts and stuff. What if John, like, just imagine if John Wick was the protagonist of one of these films. Like, I always think about that. Like, what can a ghost do to John Wick? Like, nothing, because it's just like the dude could kill you with a fingernail or some shit. So it's like, I think about that, and then it doesn't scare me.
I wonder why ghosts are so fucking lame in the beginning of a movie. Why are you opening up cupboards and shit and like, you know, leaving.
Well, they're
like,
building their power.
Leaving Andy. A trail of soft Cheerios on the floor, like.
Yeah, they're building it up. They have to gather their strength through fear. Obviously, yeah, that's how ghosts work.
The goal of phasmophobia. You
yeah.
Know?
Yeah. See, you get
every
it.
Every ghost is fucking Freddy Krueger, apparently.
Yeah, you get it. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's... Okay. Would you rather be possessed by a demon / ghost or have to fight someone possessed by demon or ghost?
Oh, easily the latter. Easily the latter. Because they're controlling a human body, and you can shut down a human body. Like, a human body can be shut. Like, I don't know. Can the ghost turn the person into a zombie? Like, are they just using it as a mechanism, as, like, a mechanical thing? Because it's like, you can just, you know, I mean, not to get too gruesome, but it's like, you disable somebody's legs, they can't walk. Can the ghost then, like, walk on broken legs? I don't know. If the ghost can do that, then that's, like, okay.
Didn't she turn her head completely backwards in The Exorcist?
Yeah, but, like... I don't know. That always kind of was like whatever.
It is weird. Like, it is weird.
If someone turns their head around and they come back, like that person's not coming back. Like
you're coming back from that.
Yeah,
like dead.
You're vertebrae. And you're like
she should have died the second the demon left her body in that movie.
Yeah. That's stuff.
Huh?
Not scared of that.
Never thought of that.
Yeah, it's actually kind of true.
I'm gonna think about that.
So, Spencer, if you were a ghost.
Oh gosh.
Do you think it'd be more like a poltergeist kind of a ghost or like a Casper the Friendly Ghost?
I mean, I don't know. Like,
depends whose house it is.
I mean, I think about that scene in the film Ghost, the romantic one, where like he meets that dude in this. Have you seen this movie?
Oh yeah,
with Patrick Swayze.
He meets, of course, yeah. It's a classic, iconic.
Like, he meets that one dude in the subway who just likes to mess with people, and the dude just like pushes all the papers down like the subway, and everybody's like freaking out. Like, I don't know. If I was just bored in like, then I guess just a little poltergeist. I don't know, just mess with stuff and like you know. But it's like if I'm angry for some reason, like if I wanted to die or if I wanted to just rest in peace and some dude like desecrated my grave or something, then I'm probably a little bit more aggressive.
That's interesting because you don't really think about all the power you would have if you can possess something like that in the physical realm. Like that would probably turn a lot of good-natured people into fuckheads. Just being able to just be like, oh, I'm fucking with this guy now.
But it's like, what can, I mean, this is like kind of the thing that I've always thought about. We're just like, what is the motivation for a demon to like possess something? Like, we're just told that like, oh, demons are evil, so they do evil shit. But like, that's so boring. Like, I think the things that where it's like, you know, if the ghosts have motivations, or if like, even if they don't have motivations, but they just like, they're shown to have some, like Hellraiser, for example, like what do they call the Cenobites? They're not really ghosts, but they're like, they have like a motivation, which is like kind of like to human beings is kind of like, okay, we have no comprehension of this. At least most of us don't. But like, you know, they still operate by some kind of logic. So you understand why they're doing what they're doing. But then you watch like, I don't know. I watched this movie Veronica recently. But like, it's like, have you seen this?
You have some really great taste.
Yeah, it's like, well, he's about to shit on it, so
I'm not getting that vibe, but still,
the horror elements are really well done. The acting, everything was really well done. But then it's just like, what is like the point of this? It's like, you know, this demon just wants to like cause trouble and like I guess take the body of this like of something. You know, this thing wants to possess this character, this thing, and just eat its soul. Like, that's just. I don't know, when you reduce like demons or ghosts, just things that are like malevolent, largely either for the sake of being malevolent or for the fact that like they're just like rabid animals where like they have no choice but to like just want to consume souls. I feel like that's just like that becomes boring, because then it's just like then you get the phasmophobia thing where it's just like, oh, I'm here to like systematically and very kind of like clinically like hunt down this thing. And if I know how to do the right steps, then it's just like, it's easy. You know, I'm not actually dealing with anything.
It's also for expedience too. Like, it's the easiest story to tell.
I think that's a
which,
little
you know, which again, it's cliche.
That becomes a monster movie. Yeah.
Right.
That just becomes a monster movie. It's the monster. You have to kill the monster. Yeah. I always think it's more fucked up when the thing has a motive that you can't understand. That,
yeah,
like, I love the, you know, Mike Myers type killer, because you just like, you get it, you know who he wants to kill, but you can't wrap your head around why he needs to do this and the lengths that he would go to do it. And you could look at it like, oh, maybe he's possessed, like, especially the last one, Halloween Ends is like, fuck. But like, yeah, like, you could look at it and be like, okay, there, it's a little reductive, but at the same time, like, his motivations are scarier because you can't explain them. I think that goes a long way for those kinds of things.
See, I would agree with that with Halloween. I think Michael Myers is like one of those characters that's like very kind of, like, he was the precedent. Like, after that, like, all the movies, like, Texas Chainsaw changed, like, Friday the 13th changed, even Freddy Krueger changed to some degree, where it's, like, all these, like, all the slashers became, like, you know, for example, I really like the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I also like the newer ones. Well, I like the latest one, right?
That was garbage.
The latest one was interesting. I actually did like it, but I thought that
I mean, Leatherface on a bus is highly amusing.
that seems pretty rough, but I like things that, like, I think I'm more partial personally to things that try to characterize like the monsters in ways that make them sort of like more comprehensible. Like, I think you know, the latest Resident Evil games, for example, have done this in a way that, like, I think is, they basically take the Texas Chainsaw Massacre approach, which is like, they try to, like, you know, create these situations where you can see just how wrong things became, and like, maybe not why they became that wrong, but you can see the process by which, like, people or like human beings just devolve into, like, you know, abject insanity or, like, you know, certain kinds of like derangement,
right,
which I find that pretty haunting. But like, when it comes to like supernatural stuff, like ghosts, like, you know, I can accept some, like, some truly dumb shit. Like, I don't know, Impulse, like, there's no, I mean, oh no, I think Impulse, actually, there is a very interesting motivation, which is that the dead are so lonely that they just spilled over, and that there's no, like, the porousness between human loneliness and, or like, living loneliness and dead loneliness is just so porous that, like, I thought that was really interesting.
It breaks my heart thinking about it. The levels of that movie.
It's very sad. Like, or you know, and like what they did with Doom, where it's like the demons were there and then like humans were here, but then like some corporation was like, no, we're just going to like farm hell. Until we're going to extract literal human suffering as like a resource, and then that unleashes the outbreak, which is like, that's like kind of dumb, but like, it's also kind of interesting. So like, as long as there's like a kind of justifiable reason for it, like, I think that, like, I'm interested in that. But when it's just like some shit where it's like, oh, like, you know, I'm some kid and I found a Ouija board and like I accidentally summoned the spirit of like I don't know, some like 13th century demon or something, and now he's just wrecking havoc in the house. Like,
or you said Bloody Mary in a mirror three times?
Easy.
Yeah, some shit like that. Easy.
Easy with that shit, all right?
That scares Steven.
Yeah, still makes it still makes my hair stand up.
It makes me nervous. Like, oh my god. I wish there was something about like the tall man or the hollow man or the something man.
The slender. Or the bye-bye man? Was that the one?
No, it was on Netflix. It was get something about like
for a movie, by the way.
The Bye-Bye Man was terrible, but like there was one that was pretty good where like he conjures up some kind of like or it's like these kids like commit this mass suicide after like conjuring the name. It starts with like them in like the Arctic. I'm not gonna try to explain this, but I thought that was really.
You don't know, Steve, what us horror fans, we suffer through a lot of garbage.
That's your fault. Like,
there's a lot of shit out there.
You could Google if a movie's good. Like, you don't need to.
There's morbid curiosity.
Look, I think horror movies are judged by a much different parameter. Like, with like, I think it's true that every genre has its fair share of just like crap that like it's just, you know, it's just made for the sake of being made. Horror is a little bit different, I think, because now I'm not gonna say horror is subjective, but horror I think is deeply like. It relies a lot on what you bring to it rather than like what it does for you. So there are certain films that like are truly horrifying for some people. Like there's one like Hell House movie. Have you seen this? Hell House, LLC.
LLC, yeah.
Everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's three of those, right? I think.
There's three of them. They get progressively like weirder.
Worse.
I wouldn't say worse. They get more like they're just the second one I thought was actually pretty good in ways that the first one wasn't. The first one was by far like I'm not gonna say objectively the scariest, but like it was they had the most even tone throughout. But, like,
right.
Those films did nothing for me because I don't give a shit about clown. Like I said, if I can see it and I can touch it, then it just doesn't bother me. But like then there's something like Grave Encounters or whatever. Or like where I watched that, and like I just want to die because like it's just all ghosts and like people with weird faces, and like
yeah, now we're eating rats. Okay, Steve.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
I listen. This has become a much different conversation, and I'm okay with that.
Okay, no, let's proceed with the rapid fire questions.
All right, I'll do. We are approaching an hour, so I will do one more, and then Andy, you'll take us home with the final question.
Sure,
you got it.
All right.
Fuck you, Spencer.
look. All right.
It's entertaining. Also, Steve, don't forget, horror can be made for next to nothing garbage and make a lot of money too. That's when we get more of it. It's cheap. It can make money, good or bad. So ask the question.
All right, Spencer.
Yes.
If you
yes, hello.
If you had the budget for one like IP AAA IP
Call of Duty
to make
unironically Call of Duty. I want to make a Call of Duty.
Unironically Call of Duty.
There's a separate part. So something that I haven't talked really about is I play a lot of games for like research. But the games that I truly play for fun are like Call of Duty and Military First Person Shooters.
Sure.
I am a fiend for these things.
Oh, you lost me, dude.
No,
it's fine. That's fine. The horrors of Vietnam. I get it.
There's something deeply fascinating about like the idea of just sort of, I don't know. I think there's something very interesting about the intersection between like the boundaries of what like we're sort of like, you know, like militaries have traditionally operated. Like I'm very interested in like specifically like the Black Ops kind of era where like dudes were just experimenting with like MK Ultra and all this shit, and like brainwashing. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, at some point they decide to like cross the zombies thing over to like the mainstream lore, which is completely weird. But I find the idea of that really interesting. Like the idea of like sort of dudes going after like, you know, when you're already looking for basically like, there's almost like a supernatural element to it, or like there's an idea of like the super ordinary, where it's like these people can just move through the world like just unfettered. Like something that really interests me is like Tom Clancy's The Division, right? Like I don't know if you guys played this game.
Sure.
Yeah. But yeah, it's this idea of like these just citizens that are just embedded, like you don't know, you don't recognize them, you don't know who they are. They don't like make themselves known. And then at the push of a button, they're like these fucking stupid watches just activate and they become like super soldiers. And like that's just so scary. There's like something deeply like unsettling about that. And like also like that the way that like
why are they so easy? Why are they so easily convinced to shoot the shit out of everything?
I but like that's that's the thing that like really interests me. It's just like the way that there's just this undercurrent, like the military just operate, like certain aspects of like military just sort of like engagements operate at a level of just like not even like it goes beyond clandestine. It becomes like truly just like something like weird in the sense of like a horror kind of weird, where it's like it just brings you into a very like, I think this is the popularity of stuff like SCP, right? Where it's like you have these soldiers effectively that are being sent to deal with like very kind of strange and horror like threats, or like the appeal of something like Control, or like you know, like the SCP, where it's like it's about bureaucracy trying to contain like things that are effectively uncontainable. I think I'm very interested in that approach, and I think that like I'm not gonna say I'm gonna take Call of Duty into like a horror direction or like a supernatural direction, but like I think that it's very interesting to explore the ways in which like, you know, like that everything can be like, if you think about things from a Tom Clancy mindset, everything can be a front, everything is a conspiracy. Like the world is just constantly like one click away from like absolute annihilation, and that like constant like a constant like idea of living on the edge.
And we peel back the layer of paranoia.
Fucking Tom Clancy, man.
Look, I'm not paranoid. I'm very optimistic.
What's behind you? In general.
But like, that idea of like these people, like these narratives exist in these like sorts of, you know, it's like they look at everything and they see like a Potemkin house. They see like an enemy lying in ambush, or they see like a, like increasingly as well with a sort of like move towards like, you know, the quandary, the moral quandaries, and the like the logistical quandary, tactical quandaries of like, you know, urban sort of like urban warfare and urban policing. It's like there's this whole kind of, there's this paranoia that develops where it's like once you start seeing something as a target, once you start seeing things from a military perspective or from a tactical perspective, everything becomes kind of alien. Everything it's becomes a source.
It loses humanity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I think Call of Duty has no balls. I'm going to say that.
What was the Fallujah game was all about. It was just like those people basically becoming monsters.
I was going to say, Spencer, I'm sure you've played Spec Ops The Line before.
Okay, I do not like Spec Ops The Line. I think Spec Ops The Line was good for its time. I think that in retrospect, it hasn't aged well. I do think that a game that I've been playing recently, though, I think that hits the same marks in a similar capacity, is Ready or Not, which is like, it's this police game where it's like you're effectively playing as like these highly militarized SWAT teams, and you get sent into these engagements that for like, I mean, in real life, like if anybody went through that kind of engagement, it'd be like a once in a career kind of thing. But it's like the way that they portray these levels, it's like you have places that are like daycares or like, you know, like mansions and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And you just increasingly encounter like more and more just insane things. Like you see like all these just implications of just incredible violence or like incredible kind of like depravity. And I don't know. It's like it creates this vision of like this world where like everything has failed. The state has failed. Like morality has failed. Like, you know, it's dealing with a very different kind of horror, I think. And that sort of, but then like you also are playing from the perspective of like, you know, this fantasy idea of like the ideal like police officer or the ideal SWAT officer, where it's like you can control your shots. Like everybody, you can distinguish cleanly between like, you know, civilians and like, you know, enemy combatants. You can like see who has a gun, who doesn't. You can force compliance. If you get shot, like that bullet is just like a little mark on your screen. It's not an actual wound. And that creates a very kind of like, it creates this like interface of alienation or isolation from the horror that you're actually encountering, where it's like, and I find that, you know, once again, returning to like the idea of sort of like horror as this kind of like pervasive or ambient anxiety, I think that games like that, you know, and it's like kind of spiritual sort of, you know, ancestor, which is SWAT 4, those games operate in the same capacity as horror games, where it's like, you know, combat in reality is a horrifying thing. I mean, I don't think anybody needs to know that, but like, or that needs to be stated like explicitly, but you know, it's this thing that like produces an immense sense of horror that doesn't exist just in the moment, but like before that moment too, and then after that moment, long after that moment. And I think that, you know, I think that there's also a place for like, you know, Michael Bay style, like, you know, you just shoot shit and like things explode.
Blow things up. Even in Resident Evil, you blow up a big monster. Like you get in a helicopter and you shoot a monster.
It's always the final set piece. You know, you get the rocket launcher or the satellite laser from space.
Yeah,
the fucking nuke. Apache helicopter shooting shit. Okay, all right, Andy, we're running late. Take us home. Right. Final question,
Spencer. This is the last question of the hour ish.
Okay,
and we'll accept nothing more than a 5-minute answer. No,
yeah,
I will not explain. I will not go further. I will not explain.
Actually, I would say ponder on it long after you've answered.
Fine. Okay. All right.
It's a simple question.
Very simple.
Yet a deviously complex question.
Interesting.
And the question is, Andy or Steven?
I will not offer any opinion on this at this time.
Interesting.
I decline to comment on this matter.
You have. Okay. All right.
We will accept.
Maybe you will.
You've given us a lot of great stuff tonight. Thank you so much.
Yeah, this was an awesome show.
It was a pleasure. It was an absolute pleasure.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You guys want to come and drink?
Oh, yeah. We're going to hang out. That's for sure.
Oh, yeah.
We could do that all night. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to bring us to the end of the show. If you like what you're listening to or watching, please consider giving us a subscribe, thumbs up, share it with your friends, leave a comment, all that fun stuff. If you want to follow us on social media, we're at @Duel_Screens. I'm at @Batchild27. Andy is at @PantsGuy. And our Facebook group is facebook.com/groups/DS podcast. And if you want to support us on Patreon, patreon.com/duelscreens, literally as little as $1 gets you into our Discord. So you can hang out with us all day long, talk video games, horror movies, regular movies. We even invite developers on in there to chat with you guys. So, yeah, it's a lot of fun. Where can everybody find you, Spencer? And where can everybody, follow My Work Is Not Yet Done?
Well, I think I'm obligated to, link the Steam page, and I don't know how I do that.
We'll have all the links.
We gotcha.
I just say wish us the game if you feel that it is something that you're interested in. I don't really care if you do it personally, but my publisher wants me to say that. You can also follow me on Twitter.
I love you, dude.
I also don't care if you follow me on Twitter, but you can add it's my name without vowels.
Attitude reflects the system requirements on the Steam page.
Oh yeah, we promised we would go into that.
Go through some of them real quick.
Just before we go, system requirements here. For the game here, minimum requirements are Windows 7 and above. Mm-hmm. The processors, any modern processor should be okay.
Should be.
Graphics, some kind of graphics processor. Sound card, can your computer play sound? Then you're probably fine. Additional notes, patience plus perseverance, a few hours of your time. The recommended, however, very important.
It's my favorite.
Windows 10 processor, whatever you can afford. Very nice. Graphics, whatever you can afford. Also good. Sound card, you guessed it, whatever you can afford. Additional notes, a poorly lit room with a W/a window, so with a window looking out into a dark yard at night.
That's it. Game of the year.
That is my work. This is not yet done.
I was cackling at this when I was looking at it.
I didn't know you could do that.
Yeah.
But what I did know is that we could say goodbye. Thank you, Andy. Thank you, Spencer. Thank you, viewers and listeners. And as always, please be excellent to each other.